it's actually doing some. Ah, and I see that.
Yep, it does in fact say that it's recording us.
Yes, and it's got. Well, the real situation with putting a Worldcon or anything that big in Atlanta is a spinoff of the SC of people deciding they wanted to have a meeting. And I didn't even get into fandom until 1975 at RiverCon. But one of the things that happened is I looked around at what the Francis's had done in Louisville, and I said, you know, we got hotels that bigger in Atlanta. And they went to 1979 and had a bleeping NASPIC in Louisville, Kentucky, mm-hmm. which, you know, I said, we can at least do that, and we actually can do a Worldcon. And in the meantime, other people have been moving on this. Notable example is database maven Joe Selko lived in Atlanta for a long time. He was one of the people on that. The author David Weber has a brother named Mike. He's been around a lot of fandom. I haven't seen him recently, hardly at all.
I haven't seen him since Hank Reinhardt's funeral.
But he was at, briefly, he was at JordanCon DSC, and I spoke to him there for the first time in years. But he was in on that. His then-wife, Sue Phillips, who still does the literary thing, she was in on that. And a guy who runs a comic book shop in Atlanta was a leading light there, Cliff Biggers, and his wife, Susan, who has some health issues now, but she was very active then and working with him. And they all were parts of this Atlanta Science Fiction Club, ASFIC, I think was the acronym, and people decided they were going to try to do that. And I was all in favor of this, but I was nobody in particular. But then something happened in my life. I got hired by a guy who ran two organizations, the Georgia Optometric Association, the eye doctors, eyeglasses doctors, and the Southern Regional Council of Optometry. He was part of that. And they had a big convention, 2,500 optometrists and another 1,000 service personnel. And that would alternate between, wait for it, Atlanta and New Orleans. Just like science fiction conventions did, because those are the two biggest cities. And so by that, I learned what was necessary to mess with a convention. So I didn't know I was preparing for anything big. And everybody who was in ASFIC also had a lot of friends in the other two cities and the ABC thing. Birmingham had a much more vibrant fandom then. Now most of the Alabama fandom that I'm aware of is in Huntsville. But then Birmingham had just as big a contingent. And Chattanooga had a big contingent already.
Right.
And since neither of those places were quite big enough and had quite the airline connections, they said, okay, we'll hold our nose. Atlanta can do it. And we'll help. And boy, did they ever help. As a matter of fact, I got a co-chair woman out of that, the wife of a then prominent attorney, since passed away, Mead Frierson. His wife, Penny Miller, was my co-chair. And basically, we split that thing up. And Penny was the meet and greet, and quietly, you are going to do this, aren't you? Lady of the thing, and I was the guy who had wandered around and with the lists and said, you know, tried to organize things. And also, when I walked into the hotel, at least the Hilton, they knew who I was. Well, I was the guy who was with the eye doctors a few years back. Now, as far as all the fandom, there's all kinds of fan politics involved, all kinds of people saying this and that. And as far as the city of Atlanta going for it, it really was amazing to me how well it, quote, just came together. Even though we had some fractures and frictions, it was amazing to me how well it came together. And it did seem now, after all these years, to be a it just happened kind of thing. But it wasn't. There were a lot of people that were analyzing this and working at it and trying to make it work. The biggest situation that I think we actually faced is that people, the fandom had tended to be centered in the publishing area, which tended to be the Boston, New York, Washington corridor. And one of the groups we were bidding against, both of them were in that corridor. New York had a bid, also using the relatively there for them new Marriott Marquis. And I don't remember which hotels Philly was using, but Philly wanted to do the convention. And so that was our opposition, and a real serious situation was that we had two strong fan groups in those cities, and also in those cities we had some people who were either pissed off at the cities, or they liked, you know, or they liked one group of people in the cities, not the others, and so you got some kind of things where everybody had something against one of the other groups. And Atlanta had two virtues. First off, it was brand new. Second off, people were already starting to have to change planes in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, well, I could just fly there and I could stop. And we had a number of good contacts that were willing to talk us up among people. And that was so we seemed to get out ahead, mostly because A, it hadn't been there. B, people had thought, you know, had finally gotten over the idea of thinking of the entire South as though it were Dog Patch from Little Ebner. And the final thing was all the airline traffic, people said, there's got to be something there. There's all the airlines. And then into this, although he never attended the convention, I'm not sure he ever realized it was there, John Portman, the architectural and developmental, you know, overlord of Atlanta in some ways, he decides that having designed two big hotels wasn't enough. He wanted to design a third one. And it was also going to be run by the Marriott, and it was called the Marquis. And they were going to be opening in 1986. And so when we walked in there to talk to those fellows, we not only had the hotel across the street, the Hilton, which was in competition with them, already interested. We also, they had nobody booked because they hadn't even had a building until they finished it.
Right.
And so we're sitting there and talking about 4,500 to 5,000 people. Actually, more than that. I think we may have gotten close to 6,000, but I honestly would have to dig it out and see.
It's a matter of record. I can look up the number.
Yeah, and but here's the other thing about it. Since we had that, those hotels were not worried about weirdness or whether a brand new ad hoc 501c3 organization could do anything. The Marriott was desperate enough, and the Hilton didn't want to give any ground to the Marriott, that the idea of working this thing out, if it was really that big, well, it turned out to be that big. And so they were very helpful. We were going to be voted on in L.A. in 1984, and L.A.'s 1984 Worldcon was held on a Hilton property.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very useful. But the... But my biggest thing was I didn't have that many enemies in the fandom. Nobody had heard of me. I actually knew what a hotel was and how to talk to it. Some fans may be wonderfully accomplished in whatever they do in their mundane life, but when they get involved with fandom, they want to, you know, kind of forget that and be something else.
Some of them do.
And so you have to, but you have to kind of keep one foot in both worlds. Mike was real good at that, and several of our other people were real good at that. Meade was an actual attorney of note in Birmingham, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
and he also had the kind of old South mannerisms and some of the connections with that world of people who, you know, looked upon this area and culture as somewhat different than the rest of the country, and that was really helpful. And then came up the matter of the guests, which you're not supposed to talk about before you're, before you're selected at all. But I think the Philadelphia people may have gotten the idea first, but somebody among the three bids got the idea. They looked around and they said, you know, Ray Bradbury has never been. And a little bit of skullduggery and digging and asking people questions, We found out that he was going to be invited by two other previous conventions, but they lost bids, but they lost. And so we did something. We not only talked about guests, we actually made an agreement. And I don't know that that would have been quite considered the right thing to do, but we all said, the rest of the guests are up to us, but if we win, it's going to be Ray Bradbury. New York said, if we win, it's going to be Ray Bradbury. Philadelphia, if we win, it's going to be Ray Bradbury. So all three of us could walk in as a group and talk to Bradbury's people and say, doesn't matter who is won, you know, Ray's going to get it. Will Ray come? And the only problem was that Ray Bradbury had a real problem with flying. Here's a guy talking about us going to Mars.
Right.
And I found out after he died, and it was on a biographical thing, that he didn't even drive a car. And he lived in Los Angeles when he moved from Illinois most of his life. I don't know how he managed that trick. I've never seen anybody in L.A. who didn't have a car attached to them, you know, as soon as they turned, say, 12. Yeah, they just, but we got him there anyhow. We got him on the plane, and but that was an unexpected hurdle, because you're not supposed to war against each other by promising a quote better guest, so you never mention it at all. But in that case, we had to make an arrangement, and it was unprecedented. I don't think it'll ever happen again, because there won't be a situation like that where a major guy has been proposed and then the organizations proposing him got beat twice. I think it was at least twice, maybe three times. It was at least twice. And so people said, no, we're going to have that. And there was a lot of cooperation there. I think the biggest thing as far as the, you know, the regional and southern fandom, what happened was really amazing, is that all the city envy kind of got settled early on. Birmingham and Chattanooga threw in pretty much with us. Nashville, under Ken Moore's, I don't know if you can call it leadership where Ken Moore was involved, but it was something. People certainly would do what he asked them to do. And we had Dan Caldwell did our art show. He was from Nashville in those days, may still be for all I know.
Less I knew he was living in Nashville.
You know, yeah, he doesn't get around much anymore. He's even older than I. There was folks in New Orleans who were cooperative then and stuff like that. And so we had a lot of people from around who were very cooperative and buried some very interesting hatchets, which that's another thing, was an advantage of having somebody like me involved. The Friersons knew where a lot of bodies were buried and had been talking to these people ever since they met and got married at the University of Alabama time frame. And then, but I didn't know anything except, you know, the local Atlanta scene, and I didn't know that much about that. And I never tried to rub anybody the wrong way, but I never also made any great effort to chat up one group or the other, because I was too dumb. There's an advantage of being dumb about some things, and that was, I think, one of that. So that was a big... The thing is that the region actually came together to put this in place, and the other thing it worked is because it was a brand new facility. It had Mr. Portman's, you know, organization behind it, and they'd know nothing about who was going to go in there, whether us or any other convention. But that meant that the Atlanta Convention and Visitors Bureau was very fond of us. Dragon Con was a gaming convention founded the same year. It was much earlier in the year. It was around this time, actually.
Okay, I thought their first event was 87.
It might have been 87, but I got the impression they also had at least a little gaming stuff going on in 86. But I could be wrong. It could be a year later. Anyway, no one was on the scene, and nobody had ever done anything like this in the area. And so it all kind of come. It was a perfect storm. You could not duplicate that again. And the only thing I kept doing was just asking people about this or that or something else. And, you know, people would sometimes make up their mind no, but more often they said yes, and most often they came through. And then there's the story of how we managed it. We budgeted very, very tightly, because we had been under the impression, and it turns out research proved this, that a lot of organizations seem to get the impression, whether they were in Europe or America, that being a nonprofit organization almost mandated them to lose money. Now, they really didn't think that, but you got the idea that that's what they thought. And some previous conventions had lost money, sometimes rather large amounts, I understood. But we budgeted very, very tightly, and then our final out-the-door price was something absolutely horrendous. I'm going to use the even number, $100 for 1986, which was tremendous. And we said it wasn't an effort necessarily to keep things down. It was just saying, okay, guys, we have plotted out for this many of you. That's how many supplies we have. Joe Selko doing the con suite had this many things lined up. We're doing, certain things. So if you come, it's that much of an additional burden on us. And what happened was it didn't bleeping matter. They showed up anyway. They paid the $75 or $100. And we wound up with revenue over expenses of a tremendous amount. I'm going to say more than $50,000. And that created the pleasant problem of, what went on afterwards. But that meant also that anything we wanted to do last minute, there was no question. I had no trouble authorizing last minute stuff once we actually had an inkling if that was happening. But it had to show up, and so we didn't authorize everything we wanted to show up.
I've heard legends of sushi in the con suite.
Joe may have done that. I didn't get up to the con suite that often.
The chair seldom does.
Yeah, the chair never does. Penny's husband was squiring around Ray Bradbury. And Penny was, going around and doing all the mom things except on this gigantic scale, working her own sons to death, etc. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there being the guy that the hotel guys would walk up to and say, is this going to happen now and that's going to happen then? And I could be there to tell them whether it was or wasn't. And they were happy as long as somebody knew. And so, yes, amazing things were done in that regard. And it also enabled us to kick a couple of other things off. For instance, I believe there was some money spent to help one of those previously airing cons out that hadn't made enough money.
I know that the 1983 in Baltimore had lost a good deal of money.
Yes, and I think we did something to help there, but, even Mike wouldn't be able to remember because the records and stuff are so long ago. I think they probably actually got soaked in it or something. I'm not sure, but I know that. And another thing is I know the Atlanta Radio Theater, I'm still involved with that. They were just spinning off as a C3 organization to be more educational and thing. They had been fairly commercial, but actually been on commercial radio for a while. And they were transitioning. We were able to get them a grant. And so that was a lot of things. But all that really was tight budgeting. It was Irvin Koch, which was different than what he actually was when you talked to him, but it was Irvin Koch obeying the stereotypes that some people have in their minds of Jewish people, really tight with it. And also, people actually cooperating among those three cities, the three closest cities, and others like Nashville, Louisville, and others. And everybody cooperating, and like I said, it was a perfect storm. You couldn't duplicate that again. Plus, there was more a sense of Southern pride than that people weren't quite yelling yet quite as much about, you racist people, you want to go back to slavery. Item A, that was absolutely absurd. And item B, the whole idea was to be welcoming, friendly, hi y'all. And that was more the image we wanted to convey of Southernness. And by gosh, most of our Southern fans conveyed that to people. A couple of things we did that were different. We had an actual public speaker give our keynote address, my congressman at the time, a guy named Newt Gingrich. He gave the keynote address. It was very much almost cribbed from two personal friends of his. They wrote Future Shock. and knew those people. Okay. And it basically was very much a future shock thing. No political, no partisan content.
He's written science fiction.
He has written science fiction. That was later, though. Mm-hmm. And then also we had an opening ceremony thing because the same guy who was involved with the Atlanta Radio Theater, Thomas E. Fuller, Tom Feller is still very much with us. He was just in the room. But Thomas E. Fuller, the longtime creative director of Atlanta Radio Theater, passed away several years ago, but he wrote a thing called a little play in one short act called Creation is a Circle, and we did that as our opening thing. I just didn't walk up there, or Penny just didn't walk up there and say, "Hey, y'all, welcome to Atlanta. The 1986 World Science Fiction Convention, the 44th Worldcon, is in session." We didn't say that. We did say that, but we had this thing, Creation is a Circle, and I was told 100 times that, my gosh, nobody's ever done that before. I found it a little hard to believe. I mean, L.A. has actors, you know, working as short order cooks. They didn't think of that? They did. Somebody may have, but they didn't do it. They didn't make it happen. And we did. And we also, we also seemed to have a level of cooperation between those hotels that didn't start until later bigger stuff started happening. They generally are very fiercely competitive between the organizations with the nameplates, which are not the people that are running it. That Hilton is owned by somebody else. It's not it's not Paris's dad.
Right.
Yeah. But, and no actual Marriott was involved with the Marriott, but their company was running it in that thing. But nevertheless, they are very fiercely competitive usually. But for that, they worked it out too. And that was fine too. It's the way things are supposed to work in this, but sometimes they don't. They did for us. And the additional thing was that at that point in time, people were willing to say that, you know, we had our little guest list and stuff seemed to tug with them. People were willing to accept the idea that Ray Bradbury was a major force in literature, whether or not they believed he wrote science fiction. No, all three of the guys who were running the bids for the three cities, all three of us had been approached by members either of our committee or close friends in fandom and said, "I hear you're going to." We can't talk about who we're going to ask for guests, but Bradbury does write science fiction. We said, we can't talk about who we're inviting for guests, you know. But nevertheless, people had figured that out, sort of. On the other hand, a lot of people had said, gee, it's time. You know, we've honored Heinlein three or four times. We haven't gotten around to Clifford Simak, so why not? Why not Ray Bradbury? He's pretty good. He's been around a while. And so that went over very well and everything else, and we only had one untoward incident at the Hugos, and it wasn't an untoward incident. Somebody refused a Hugo, but I won't go into that. It's necessary. So we're still working. So it was, again, perfect storm. Everything went very well. I don't recall actually doing anything, which means I must have done a lot, but nevertheless, if I can't recall it, it must have been all detail shit that's now passed away. And we didn't have any serious, real monetary situation, and and that was because people came anyway, which is the other thing about all conventions. If you can get, well, I don't think we had very much local publicity, but we had a little tiny bit, a couple of mentions and articles in newspapers, and everybody talked it up in fandom. And this was the first time the people in the region had been able to go to something that they could get to if they had to drive for 4 hours. And that also contributed to a number of people showing up who had never shown before. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And that's off the cuff, and I'm sure I've forgotten a lot of people. I didn't mean to. I tried to mention all the folks that I remember were there. Of course, you know, there were leading lights of fandom around, Jerry Page, Hank Reinhart, and stuff, and they were helpful, too. But, you know, as far as the committee grows, it was people, either from and out of ASVIC, like myself from Atlanta, the Birmingham Club, which was more or less Mead and Penny, were in and Charlotte Proctor. And Jerry Proctor was a newspaper editor in those days.
So was that the club that published Anvil?
Yeah, that's the club that published Anvil. Charlotte probably actually had more to do with that club than the Friersons, but they, but nevertheless, they were involved in that. We had a number of people from the Huntsville area. Some of them genuine rocket scientists at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, these people, if still alive, are now retired from NASA, and retired from the Army thing there, or serving as consultants. But they were very much, you know, active and having to work in those days, and we still had a space program in those days. What the hell happened to our space program? That's the end of my political statement. you know, they were all helpful. The Chattanooga fans were absolutely marvelous. Mike was living in Atlanta in those days, but he certainly never forgot the place where he came from. And we even, once we had won the thing, we even had people that helped out. Oh, and there's one person who was on our committee but never got to show up. He did a lion's share of work. Joe D. Sicleri, Joe Ed. Now, he's back in New York, I understand, but he was living in Boca Raton at the time. And here's two little personal notes, tragedies for both Joe and myself. My mother passed Memorial Day of 1986, or actually the Sunday before it, and Joe's father was diagnosed with, I believe, cancer and passed away in the fall, but he was still had to be taken care of, right. And Joe was the one, so Joe could not get to Worldcon. And I wish that Joe Sicleri had been able to be there, and there wouldn't have been any brickbats. He would have been able to do it. He would have, you know, we would have worked things out, and he would have gotten all the accolades that he deserved there, but he did a lot of work. We had a guy who has since moved out to I believe, Arizona area. Avery Davis did a lot of our, work on the operations part of things. There just was a lot of things, like I said, it just came together in a way that's really difficult to describe. It was not a complete accident, but it seemed a lot more accidental than it was, and it worked so well, and I think we did so well is partly to blame for something that a lot of written SF fans get a little disturbed about, DragonCon, because if you had that going on, and it was also called science fiction, the hospitality industry, which thinks movies are also science fiction, not that they can't be, it's just that they don't seem to make it. Another editorial comment there. Nonetheless, I think that sort of smoothed away from them. Unfortunately, though, it was so wearing to do that that I basically took every year beginning 199 off from fandom. So what was said to me by a famous author, that my reward for running a good WorldCon would be to run out of the local club on a rail. That really didn't happen, but I did find myself going, can I live my life now? And I went off and sort of did that. And so I'm only now getting back in when I'm retired and useless. The amazing kind of things that went on, the weirdness, the people attempting to pull fast ones on a new group of people that they had never heard of before, that were a new corporation that they'd never seen before. You know, my God, there could be 1,000 stories, but fortunately I don't remember most of them. And basically what I remember is people being amazingly cooperative, even if they didn't like each other. And or at least if you read the old APAs, you would get the impression they certainly didn't like each other if you read either the actual words or sometimes you had to go between the lines, but usually you didn't have to go very far between the lines. Either they just said, so-and-so is really stupid about that idea, and it sometimes got personal. But we had a lot less of that than I thought we would ever have, and things worked out, and we did a couple of things that were new and worked. And the whole idea of lining those hotel up in a line, and even using a couple of rooms in the Regency Hyatt House. So we had two of Portman's three massive buildings working for us. Even that worked. So I have to say it was a great success, and I can remember it fondly now. Certainly, if somebody was talking to me about this in 1991, I would have darker memories. So I hope that gives you some notion.
Oh, yeah, that's a great half hour. As a formality, you want to make sure that you're comfortable with this being used for fanzines and other similar historical projects.
Yes, because they don't know where to find me.
All right.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. Like I said, the only thing I hope I could not mention everybody's name, and, off the top of my head, I do remember, people who helped. We may not have been the very first one, but I think we were one of the first ones to have somebody that actually looked after whether folks who had some problems moving around and other things could do that. And there's a lady named Samantha Judy, and I'd have to look that up to remember how to spell that, but she herself is a victim of polio, and mm-hmm. she was interested in being able to move her wheelchair around in places. And so we actually had a serious effort to try to work out. And the Americans for Disabilities Act, I think, was brand new at the time. So,
well, it didn't come through until the 90s.
It didn't come through in the 90s? Okay, so there was literally no acknowledgement of that. But where the hotels were already starting to think about it, Samantha then made sure they thought about it harder. And we also probably were as accessible as it was possible to be in that time, and that was largely her and her husband Don Cook's effort on that part. And so they made it a little bit easier for those people. I won't say easy, because sometimes nothing is easy, even for those of us who still have all our feet working. but that kind of thing happened, and again, it came together because we had the right people, and they thought this was cool and wanted to work on it. And also, I got to admit, there was a strong desire among a lot of people to say, the South is really as good as the rest of the country. We can hold these things too. And I think we proved it. But who knows?
Well, thank you.
So there you go. I hope you can use some of that, or maybe even all of it.